Nicolet Bank is honored to support all who strive to make communities great. Newsmakers is a production of Wisconsin Eye. To keep programs like this free and accessible to all, please consider a charitable gift to wisi.org/donate or text WISI to 44321. This program is brought to you from Wisconsin Eye's Margaret Farrow Studio.
Hello and welcome to Newsmakers. I'm your host, Lisa Pugh. By now, you've likely heard of H5N1 or bird flu, which has been sweeping the country and is now linked to the first human case in Wisconsin. While the CDC says the risk to humans remains low, experts are advising that people take some precautions. We are talking to Wisconsin's experts on this issue, Dr. Keith Paulson, who is the director of the Wisconsin Veterinary Diagnostic Laboratory, Dr. Darlene Conkle, the state veterinarian with the Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection, and Dr. Angie Maxted, who is the state public health veterinarian with DHS. Welcome to all three of you.
Thanks for the opportunity.
All right, we have a lot to get through. I want to start with, what's the basic history of this virus? When did we first start seeing it?
Well, I think our lab has been activated and working with our public health and animal health colleagues now since 2022 with now the worst foreign animal disease in U.S. history, with the H5N1 strains moving through poultry and wild birds. And I think we're up into the 40s in the different strain number of species of mammals detected. But in right around this time last year, we were working on a spillover into dairy cattle, which has been identified since, I think, March 29th of 2024. And that's what we've been dealing with ever since, with a specific strain called B313. And now we're seeing some D1.1, which is a new strain out west. So it's been quite a ride the last 2 years.
Just since 2022.
Mm-hmm.
When did we first start seeing things change in Wisconsin?
In the spring of 2022, Wisconsin saw our first cases in domestic poultry of this H5N1 virus. And throughout 2022 and into 2023, then that first group of cases, I think we had 29 cases in poultry, some commercial and some backyard flocks.
So how big of a deal is it that this virus has gone from birds to mammals? I think the CDC on their website says more than 200 mammals, and now including dairy cattle. How big of a deal is that?
Yeah, certainly. There's always a concern with influenza viruses in animals that they could jump to people. There have historically been sporadic cases of avian and swine influenzas in people, but certainly it's something to keep our eye on. The more the longer that this virus circulates in animals, the greater the chance it could come into contact with people and jump into people. And of course, we want to keep the virus from transmitting from person to person.
How has the way this virus has mutated and changed over the last few months? How has that changed your level of worry about it from maybe, say, a year ago?
I think from the animal health side, and maybe Dr. Maxted, Dr. Conkle can comment on the public health side, what has changed in dairy cows is we have typically really only seen a B3.13 strain. And it really didn't change.
What does that mean?
Yeah, that's just like a specific species or a serotype. So flu changes a lot, and they change numbers, and then they change different receptors and things like that. But in dairy cows, we really didn't see much change. It was really well adapted to the mammary gland of the cow. They were shedding a lot of virus in milk and mammary secretions, but it didn't really change much. It really liked it. It was changing less than what we typically
see. And
that's
a good thing as far as a virus spread is concerned.
Right. And then recently in January, we did see two new introductions in Nevada and Arizona, which had some reassortment for what we call mammalian adaptation from a very specific receptor that we've been looking at and we knew was a risk. But mammalian adaptation does not mean increased mortality in people. It just means that it potentially could be more easily recepted or transmitted by mammals. And I think what that meant was is that all of our public health and animal health experts have been talking about, you know, this influenza is probably the biggest risk of a next potential pandemic pathogen in people, yet, I mean, there's a lot of large barriers to get to that. So we thought the risk, and currently the risk is still low, but as we see that reassortment for mammalian adaptation, that's a pretty big step in that direction, even if the risk remains low. I'm not sure how else you might think about that, Dr. Mattson.
What's the current status of the spread of the virus in Wisconsin?
In Wisconsin, most recently in December, we did see 3 cases in domestic poultry, 2 commercial flocks and 1 backyard flock. Since then, we haven't had any detections in Wisconsin in domestic birds. Our Wisconsin DNR has informed us of some wild bird detections, and at this time of year, that's not uncommon. We have not detected any in dairy cattle in the state of Wisconsin
that's good
to date.
News.
Yes.
Dr. Maxted, has your level of worry about this particular virus changed over the last year?
I think it has, from the standpoint that it continues to circulate. There has been previous introductions of avian influenza, highly pathogenic avian influenza virus, into the United States that have gone away without continued spread. But the fact that the virus still continues to be in wild birds and continues to circulate in dairy cattle in other states and continues to spill over into poultry brings the virus into contact with people more often.
We said at the top of the show last December was when DHS reported the first human who had contracted H5N1 bird flu. That was in Barron County. Can you remind us how that person got the flu?
Sure. That person was somebody who was working with poultry. They were working with a flock that was known to be infected with H5N1. And they started to feel sick about a couple of days after the birds started to get sick. The person had also worked with depopulating poultry on that farm, so they were working directly with infected animals.
What are typical symptoms?
Typically people will come down with either a conjunctivitis, which is very common in people who've been infected with this strain, which is eye redness, irritation, tearing, or they could come down with very typical flu-like symptoms such as fever, chills, sore throat, runny or stuffy nose, muscle aches, cough.
Do we have a mortality rate for this bird flu for humans?
There have been 70 human cases in the United States. There has been a handful of hospitalizations with that, and then there has been 1 death. That was unfortunately a person in Louisiana who had contact with backyard poultry.
Let's show the map of the human cases across the country. There has been a growing number of human cases. The CDC reports, as you say, 69 cases in 12 states just since last April when the first human infection was reported in Texas. As you mentioned, there's 1 death. It happened just in January of this year in Louisiana. The Louisiana Health Department says that patient contracted H5N1 after exposure to a combination of non-commercial backyard flock and wild birds. Dr. Poulsen, is it important to note that this virus has not mutated to include human-to-human transmission? That's a pretty big detail, correct?
Absolutely. And I think that's one of the key talking points to anyone that we're talking about, is that human-to-human transmission is a pretty significant step, and we are nowhere near that at this point. Although the longer the virus is in the environment, the bigger that risk becomes. But once, if human-to-human transmission were to come out, then we're dealing with a completely different scenario with a public health emergency. So we're not there yet, but that's the reason why we want to get rid of it before any further changes would happen.
Dr. Maxted, I know the DHS website says something on it that you just mentioned before, that viruses that spread from animals to people have the potential to mutate or combine with human influenza viruses to become more infectious variants. Would you be surprised to see this virus mutate to include human-to-human transmission?
So far, we don't have any indication that there is a higher risk to humans at this point. But influenza viruses are unpredictable, and that's a key reason why we want to prevent human infections, and especially to prevent that co-infection, like you mentioned, of between an animal virus and a human virus. Prevention of seasonal influenza virus in people who are around animals that could be infected is important too, which is why influenza vaccines are recommended for anyone over the age of 6 months, but especially for people who work with animals.
I'm sure the question on everyone's mind is, are we on the path to another pandemic? How do we know?
Well, I think the very large infrastructure that we have between animal and human health with USDA and the National Animal Health Laboratory Network, as well as CDC and our State Laboratory of Hygiene here, along with 130 satellite laboratories, is that surveillance is key. So we have to know where virus is and where virus isn't, and then how is it changing, because that's how we decide where to put resources, where to move resources, and how concerned that we need to be, whether we need to depopulate a flock because they're affected, or if we start seeing reassortment into other species like swine.
How does the Department of Health Services assess the risk of any movement toward a pandemic scenario?
Sure. One way we are doing surveillance for human influenza viruses of course, right now is the middle of flu season, so we've got high levels of flu A and flu B circulating right now. We are doing monitoring of those viruses, some enhanced surveillance, laboratory surveillance of those viruses to make sure that what we're seeing amongst people is human flu and not an avian influenza or a different type of influenza.
And the department is doing wastewater monitoring.
Absolutely.
Correctly. So
yes.
What is that showing, if anything?
Well, wastewater monitoring is something that came out of the COVID pandemic, and we've been very lucky to be able to use that for other purposes. So far, it has shown plenty of human flu, but no avian influenza in our wastewater systems that would suggest that it is circulating undetected amongst people.
And that would be the first sign, one of the first indications that we had a greater problem.
Yes, it certainly could be. And it also, we do offer testing for people who've been exposed to H5 influenza. Anybody who is concerned for their health or has becomes ill after contact with known infected animals, we offer testing at the State Lab of Hygiene for free.
It's voluntary.
Absolutely, yes.
Okay. Dr. Conk, I want to ask you about those cases in poultry flocks in Wisconsin. You mentioned in December alone, three flocks that were impacted. Where were those outbreaks and how many birds were impacted?
Two of them were in northwest Wisconsin, one in Barron County and one in Burnett County, and the other was in Kenosha County, so kind of widely separated geographically. They were all three this D1.1 genotype that we've seen circulating in wild birds and poultry in the U.S. As far as numbers of birds, I'm going to give a ballpark here, but around 50,000 commercial birds in those two different outbreaks. The backyard flock was smaller.
And what does DADCAP do when there is an outbreak in a flock? Do all those birds need to be destroyed?
They do need to be depopulated, yes. I think it's important to remember that in poultry, this virus is very lethal. It moves very quickly, and it is highly pathogenic, so the birds move from a state really where they're asymptomatic to where they're not feeling very well, and that's when the flock owners are calling us right away, when they're detecting the slightest change in feed intake or water intake or starting to see abnormal signs. They're suspicious of this right away and they call. So yes, those birds, our actions are to work with with our USDA colleagues and with the lab, and with we also work collaboratively with Division of Public Health as well. But for the response to an infected poultry flock, we do depopulate those birds as humanely as possible and as quickly as possible because we're trying to avoid spread to other flocks.
I know that nationally, just over the last 30 days, 23 million infected birds across states. How is that impacting the poultry industry overall?
And that's a little difficult to say. I know, you know, we have seen those depopulations, so 23 million birds of various species, turkeys, laying hens, some duck flocks as well, have needed to be depopulated, and it does take some time for those flocks then to go through a process of cleaning and disinfection, virus isolation before they can repopulate. So we have seen some reductions in poultry numbers in other states.
And this is connected to our high egg prices?
Yes, and I think that's a really important point of why we depopulate. Just to reiterate what Dr. Kunkel had said, high lethality. These birds, they will die on their own, so we certainly were trying to do the most humane disposal as possible, and to keep the virus out of the environment. And they certainly can't enter the food chain, which is very different than our dairy cattle species. So whether coming back into where egg prices are, where the consumer is feeling that right now when you go to the store, that's not something that's going to have a short-term fix or a medium-term fix. It's a minimum 75-day turnaround from an egg to a chicken that lays an egg. And when you look at the number of laying hens out of the 280 million bird population, it's going to take months for that to come back, assuming that the virus actually dies down, which it really hasn't done so in certain key producing egg-producing states like Ohio, Indiana, and Pennsylvania.
What is your advice to people who have backyard flocks of chickens? What should they be doing?
They should be watching their chickens really closely for any abnormal clinical signs, any signs of illness. I mentioned a drop in feed intake, you know, chickens not feeling well, and call us if they do see those signs. Our veterinarians on staff can help walk backyard flock owners through whether this is likely to be highly pathogenic avian influenza or not. And certainly if we are suspicious, we can expedite testing through the Wisconsin Veterinary Diagnostic Lab. But we also want to make flock owners aware of just good biosecurity practices and tips in, for doing that. We have lots of information on our website for biosecurity tips for people. But that's going to vary a lot by flock, what works and what doesn't. But some of the main things are to keep things very clean, to use dedicated clothing and footwear when working with your birds, and to keep them as separated from as possible from any contact with wild birds or wild waterfowl.
But it's, we're at a state where it probably is important to be paying attention if you have a backyard flock.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Unlike in other states, I know that we have been fortunate that we have not seen this virus in our dairy cattle, but that's not the case nationally. The U.S. Department of Agriculture reports that since the first case was discovered in dairy cows in Texas almost a year ago, March 2024, as you mentioned, there have been 972 infected dairy herds across 17 states, with 36 new cases reported in just the last 30 days. Dr. Max said, is it possible that this virus is getting into the milk that we drink or purchase from the grocery store?
I do know that virus has been detected in some commercial milk specimens that have been tested. Pasteurization is 100% effective at killing this virus, so there's no need to worry about the milk that you're buying at the grocery store having infectious virus in it.
The milk is completely safe.
Yes, pasteurized milk is completely safe. Of course, we recommend against drinking raw or unpasteurized milk. There's lots of good public health reasons to do so. Many other organisms can be in there, and that recommendation still stands.
Dr. Paulson, given how rapidly the virus seems to be spreading among certain animal species, would you be surprised to see it show up in Wisconsin dairy cows?
Right now, I'm cautiously optimistic that because of how we move lactating cows in and out of the state, which we tend not to move a lot of lactating cows into the state. I think that's a big reason why Wisconsin hasn't reported flu. We also have a lot of surveillance of retail milk products off the shelf in different research labs. Still haven't seen it. Some of the state orders for exhibition and show have not shown any cattle that have been affected. And we don't have any wastewater testing. And that's really important to be able to look at an entire herd or an entire kind of rural community. And with entering into the National Milk Testing Strategy, I think that surveillance is going to get even better. I do think it's important that even if we've only had 972 you have, that's a small estimate, or it's well underrepresenting of what we've actually had. I think the estimates this fall were about 3,500 based off of the dairies around the country, and there's 27,000 total herds. So there are challenges with surveillance and reporting. So we're far under reporting dairy cases and human cases because of the challenges of location in states, rural provision of healthcare, and a large migrant workforce. So it's much bigger than what's actually been reported.
Dr. Conkle, DADCAB, last week said, as Dr. Paulson referenced, that Wisconsin would be participating in the National Milk Testing Strategy. What does that mean? What will farmers be required to do?
Actually, our plan, we're getting our plans together for that, because obviously we do have a large number of dairies in Wisconsin compared to a lot of other states. The actual dairy farmer, through the course of this testing through the National Milk Testing Strategy, really shouldn't see anything different. Their milk gets picked up and tested regularly for other reasons, and we're going to piggyback on that same system.
Just an additional test.
An additional test done on that same milk that's taken for other types of testing. We've been working with the diagnostic lab, the veterinary diagnostic lab, on plans for getting into the logistics of how to do this efficiently.
How frequently will that testing happen then?
It'll be basically what we're thinking now is on a monthly system, or a monthly rolling system, with the dairy farms getting tested about monthly.
What are the dangers of continued spread within dairy herds nationally?
Well, when we look at the costs of infection on the farm, that cost is primarily the burden is on the farmer. So you're going to see milk drop. We'll also see loss of production bonuses due to somatic cell count, milk quality, fat, protein volume. They're also going to see about 50% of turnover for animals that are affected. So they'll move into what we call the cold collar market for the beef production. Those costs are almost primarily on the shoulders of the farmer and the taxpayer, because the taxpayer is providing some support through different indemnity programs. And then I think now a really large cost that's starting to come in more and more is the cost of replacement animals. So as those animals move through the herd, those replacement animals are 2 to 3 times what they were even a year ago. So that becomes really untenable to a lot of farms. And because those replacement animal costs are even higher, we could see more farms actually selling out if they're getting to that point where maybe the kids are gone and there's no one to take over. The cost of replacement cows are really, really high right now. It might be that might be the time where we need to get out of the market, and we might see fewer Wisconsin farms, which is a challenge for all of our rural communities. So.
Well, and again, we haven't seen it in Wisconsin dairy cattle, so that's good news. What kind of precautions are you asking farmers to take?
Mm-hmm. Again, we've got lots of information on our website, but we are asking farmers, dairy farmers basically, to do some of the same things we're asking poultry growers to do, which is keep very close tabs on the health of their herds and to work with their herd veterinarians. And if they're seeing signs they think might be suspicious of H5N1, to give us a call. And we've received several of those calls over the past months, and we've worked with the laboratory to expedite testing. And again, we haven't picked it up in Wisconsin. So there are other diseases that can cause similar signs. But we're also asking dairy farmers to up their biosecurity, to look at their farm protocols and look at their employee training protocols and do what they can to increase biosecurity, to avoid tracking the virus in And again, looking at those cattle movement protocols and trying to isolate any new cattle that come to the farm for a period before introducing them to the rest of the herd. And again, each dairy farm is going to be a little different on what biosecurity practices are going to work best for them.
Dr. Paulson, there's been some criticism with how the federal government has handled the spread of this virus. Would you say that this virus should have been prevented from spreading into so many dairy herds?
I think it's easy to look back and say we should have done something differently. I think it's such a complex interaction between the actual virology or the animal science of how the virus moves. We spent 2024 and apparently a big election happened, right? So there's a lot of stress due to the elections. And then just the sheer economics of whether it's domestic or international markets. So I think from a pure science perspective, I think we certainly could have done a better job, and we still can do a better job. We can always be better. But we have to remember, what resources do we have available? What's our end goal? And then what are our risks? So that still is yet to be seen, because, you know, everyone is vying for those same resources. And we've seen what has happened now with the continued spread around the country. And so I do think that we still have an opportunity. We haven't lost the end goal. We can still eliminate this virus from the dairy herd. Poultry, I think, is going to be a little bit more challenging because they're much more susceptible, and we continue to see the wild bird reservoir. But we can still do it. There's a lot of things that we need to work out, whether it's through animal science and new administrations and industry experts.
Dr. Max said, with the new administration, there's been some changes already in the approach to public health at the federal level. Senator Baldwin just sent a letter to President Trump criticizing the level of information that the CDC has been sharing with states around things like bird flu. There's also been some termination of some federal workers who are seen as on the front lines of some public health initiatives in communities. Do you think that the federal government needs to really prioritize its approach to the bird flu?
Well, I have to admit we are concerned that there has been some communication pauses between CDC and their state and local partners. We are certainly concerned to see that people are being laid off in a time when there is a public health and an animal health response needed to this virus. I'll say that though we still have been in communication with our counterparts in other states, the state veterinarians and the state public health veterinarians are in touch, and so we've been able to maintain a national picture of what's going on with bird flu in humans. It also has not altered our commitment to partnering within our state with Dr. Conkle, Dr. Paulson, and other state partners to work together on this.
Dr. Conkle, anything else the federal government could be doing?
You know, I think we've had good partnerships with our federal counterparts just at the state level and the national level. Lots of communications, as Dr. Maxted alluded to, on sharing information, sharing what we know and what we don't know about this virus, and at the laboratory level as well. The National Veterinary Services Laboratories of USDA have been really working hard to stay on top of this virus and doing a lot of sequencing and sharing that information so we can continue to learn from this virus.
We're coming up on the 5-year anniversary of the COVID-19 pandemic. Are we putting lessons learned to use here? Do you think we're in a better position to handle a potential, maybe far-off, future pandemic?
I certainly hope so. You always want to make sure that you're learning and not reinventing the wheel or repeating the mistakes of past. And I think the memory span gets a little bit short, because no one liked wearing masks, right? Mm-hmm. There are a lot of issues with getting the population to do public health best practices, even just things like washing your hand. That's hard to get a population to do. But hopefully we can, and I think from the regulatory side or our state and federal officials, we certainly learned a lot about how to run thousands of samples per day in a very efficient manner and be able to share the data around. But it's not necessarily known best practice. We know how to do this. We have the expertise. We have the infrastructure and the materials to do it. We just have to choose to do it. That's the hard part.
The will.
Yeah, the will, and making sacrifices for one thing versus another to then be able to do those best practices, which is always kind of a balancing act.
Remains to be seen how we would handle another pandemic scenario. I want to close out the show, Dr. Maxted, with asking you how humans can remain safe. We know that there's not human-to-human transmission, but we have a slide, but I'll let you also share with people what those safety precautions are.
Sure, and I'll mention that we have on our website some tips and tricks. We also have a website that's dedicated to farm worker health and safety, which I think is really important. Of course, the vast majority of the human cases we've seen so far are in people who worked with infected poultry or infected dairy cattle in other states. So there's specific precautions that people who are in contact with infected animals need to take, such as wearing personal protective equipment that's appropriate to the situation. In a lot of cases of those that are most exposed, that will include things like overalls or a gown, gloves, dedicated work boots, a hairnet, eye protection, respiratory protection. Of course, that's the Cadillac version for the people who are most affected. For most of your viewers, I think, that are not working directly with infected animals, a couple things are just to keep in mind: the situational awareness, be aware of what's going on, be sure to cook your food to safe temperatures, avoid drinking unpasteurized milk, even though we haven't seen it in Wisconsin yet. That's good practice. I also want to mention that something that's concerning is that we've seen some cases of this virus in domestic cats that have had exposure with infected animals, and I think that's really important to be sure to protect our own animals at home, absolutely, by if you're working with infected animals, then making sure that you're not bringing the virus back home with you, but also avoiding raw pet food diets and raw unpasteurized milk, which have been linked to cat cases in some other states. Of course, we don't have to worry about that in dairy cattle in Wisconsin at this point, but protect our pets is very important.
Well, thank you for that advice, and thank you all for the great information today. Really important conversation. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you.
Great. Thank you.
Right. And thank you to the viewers of Newsmakers. Be sure to tune in again as we highlight the issues and sit down with the decision makers who make a difference for all of us.
Nicolet Bank is honored to support all who strive to make communities great. You have been watching a production of Wisconsin Eye, your unfiltered window into legislative deliberations and public policy programming, where our mission is to provide Wisconsinites an opportunity to access the legislative process and connect with conversations that inform our citizenry. Please consider supporting our mission, and thank you for watching. Wisconsin Eye, policy made public.